I think one of the bar cards actually.
And I thought, oh, is there Jim Haverson?
Morning. Bright and early Monday morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. We are finally in March. I know this is a moment we've all been waiting for.
Yeah, there's too many dancers.
March 2nd. We've got a few public hearings. We do have a bill that was carried over from last Friday as well. But we are going to start with Representative Barnhart and open a public hearing on House Bill 2577. Yeah, Jan, why don't you go ahead and describe the bill and take a few words away from the representative.
Chair Holvey and committee members, this is a measure that makes the legislative finding that property owners benefit by a state building code requirement that construction of certain parking facilities should include electrical supply capacity and conduit to support vehicle charging stations. It requires the director of DCBS to include in the state building code a requirement for certain new construction to include electrical supply capacity and conduit to support installation of charging stations for at least 20% of the parking spaces, and that the capacity and conduit are adequate to support simultaneous charging at 3% or more of the spaces. It states that the provision does not mandate the installation of charging stations and applies to permits after January 1st, 2016.
Good morning, Representative. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and I'm very pleased to be here this morning in support of House Bill 2577. The description you've heard, I think, is a pretty good one. Let me just add a couple of things. The point of this bill is to require that in new construction, the things that are of low cost to install at the beginning of things and to design for and plan for at the beginning of things are very low cost at that time, which become very expensive if you retrofit, if you're trying to do it in an older building where you'd have to be digging up concrete or adding to your electric room or other things of that sort that require huge expenses. So the object is do the low cost things, do the things which are low cost when you're building the new building, so that you don't have to do them later. It does not require the installation of charging stations themselves. Doesn't indicate that the technology that we have now is going to be frozen in place because you need wires to do to install charging stations, and installing conduit and service simply means that those wires and those charging stations can be installed at the time that somebody wants to use them. And there'll be whatever the state of the art is at the time. I want to talk a little bit about why it is that we would want to do such a thing. Why would we want to add a requirement, however inexpensive it is, to building? And we're talking about large parking structures, not small ones. We're talking about open parking with a substantial number of spaces, and I'll refer you to the bill to see exactly what that means. I want you to think for a minute about the difference between fueling electric vehicles and fueling a gasoline-powered car. The question I get most of the time when people ask me about my Tesla Model S automobile that I've been driving for 2.5 years back and forth from Eugene to Salem and other places is, how long does it take to charge to refuel it? Why does it and is it inconvenient to do that? The reality is it takes 15 seconds to fuel my electric car when I have the facilities available. Let me explain what I'm talking about. Everyone here knows about fueling a gasoline-powered car. Your car is at a quarter of a tank. You've got to drive to the gasoline station. You've got to fill it up. You've got to drive home, or you've got to drive on to your next destination. It takes a half an hour every time you do it. So, you know, that seems convenient because we're used to it. The fact is, charging an electric vehicle, when you have the proper facilities, is much more convenient and much easier. And when are those proper facilities? They are the facilities at home, when your car is parked overnight, and there are the facilities at work when your car is parked for several hours while you're at work. My car is in the garage downstairs right now. It's plugged into a utility outlet, And over the next couple of days, while I'm in Salem, it will completely recharge itself being plugged in there during the day, even though I don't have facilities where I'm staying overnight to charge it. And it's really that simple. Fueling electric vehicles is actually easier and more convenient than fueling a gasoline-powered car if you can plug in at home and or plug in at work. So that's what we're aiming for. When I installed my electric charger at home, I had already done some remodeling on the house. I knew I was going to need service, and I installed the service. It cost $100 to put the plug-in in place and attach it to the switch panel so that I could use it. We also have a condominium in Portland. I wanted to be able to charge my car at the condominium in Portland. Otherwise, it was a mile walk to the nearest charger. Nobody's going to put up with that for very long. But it costs over $3,000 to run a conduit along the ceiling of the parking garage and install exactly the same plug-in that I had in Eugene. So, and that was because we had to retrofit. Convenience charging, 15 seconds. It takes about 8 seconds to get out of the car and plug the car in, and about 8 seconds to unplug it. All the time in between, you're doing something else, and therefore the fact that it takes several hours to charge doesn't matter. Why should you care? It's great for the economy. Every electric car reduces the amount of oil and gasoline that we import into Oregon and keeps more money home. Great for reducing carbon pollution. 52% of Oregon's carbon pollution comes from transportation fuels. Every bit of it that we get, that we can take away by using electric vehicles, we go toward our goal, our long-term goal of being carbon pollution free. And of course, the most important reason, it's a gas to drive. This car is fast, it's fun, it's easy, and it's comfortable. Why now? We have 200-mile vehicles coming, 200-mile range vehicles coming. The Model 3 from Tesla will be out in 2017. The General Motors will put out its Bolt. It's a B, not a V. Also a 200-mile car, also announced for 2017. Buildings that we are talking about starting construction on next year will last for a long time. Retrofitting is expensive. Plan ahead. Do it now. California is already ahead of us, as they often are in this particular context. Their rule goes into effect on July 1 of this year. Their rule is much broader than the one I've proposed. It applies to everything, to every size of facility. Mine only applies to the big ones. It's subject to discussion, I think. And this bill only applies to multiple unit dwellings, large ones, and to large work sites. I think it's best if we move aggressively on a bill like this, that it be done especially by local government or by the Building Codes Division. There are a lot of details in this bill. I'm not wedded to any of them. I'm certainly willing to consider a bill that asks for a report back on progress toward pilot projects rather than the adoption of the bill as it's written, or simply an agreement from the Building Codes Division that they will proceed on it. The simple fact that I've introduced this bill has already led to some others to take a second look at the idea of holding pilot projects around the state for the purpose of requiring these kinds of facilities be built into new buildings. I think you'll hear from some people behind me who will talk about those possibilities. I think that if the pilot projects are well underway by the beginning of next session, that the legislature probably won't need to take any action at all, because I do believe that the Building Codes Division has the authority to order this kind of addition to the building code statewide when it's ready to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. I appreciate you ending just as our alarm went off, designating you'd hit your time limit.
I'm glad you noticed why I had it on.
I hit my 25 minutes. Is that right?
35.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be, because I heard the added expense, and I understand the difference between putting it in your garage, because I put in an electrical outlet, and I just did it myself. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, for the plug and everything, $40 to do it for the quick charger. So, because it's a short run. But if we're going to do this. It can be a big expense, as you saw, $3,000 to run conduit and stuff. And we're asking someone when they're building a garage to put this in and have that added expense. Then who would be responsible for paying for the power, just like when, like here, people pull up or we have the plugs here, they pull in and charge at the state. Who pays for that? Who would pay at the parking garage when somebody pulls up and plugs into it? How is the building owner or the garage owner going to be compensated for a lot of this?
Mm-hmm. I think those are great questions. Let me sort of hit them in order. When you install a conduit in the concrete before you build a building, it's very, very inexpensive. I think some people behind me will give you more details about that. But it doesn't cost anything like the kind of dollars I had to spend. It's much less expensive to do it. The number I keep hearing from California is it's about $50 per space where you do it, rather, you know, to install the conduit. For charging, of course, you need a charger or a plug-in, as you say, and the wire to connect you to the electrical service. And, of course, the service itself has to be robust enough to allow for that. Installing robust service as part of the building plan is inexpensive. Retrofitting later, going back and adding another panel, drilling holes through the concrete foundation and installing more wire and so forth, all of that is very expensive. If it's part of the plan, it's very cheap. Now, to your last question, who pays? Right now, the building administrator here charges $1.25 a day for using his utility plugins, which are level one plugins, that end up costing slightly more than the cost of the power. And I pay him for the use of the plugin here. I pay him $25 a month, and that's roughly the same amount for using the plugins. At a condominium, we already have a law in place where an individual can install an electric vehicle charger at his own expense makes an arrangement with the with either the electric power provider or with the condominium homeowners association to pay for the power. That law is already in place. It was adopted last year, I think it was last year. It may have been 13. Who knows when you're having fun. Right? So those issues have already been dealt with, and the cost of the actual installation of the charger, the wiring, and the paying for electricity would be on the person who actually wanted to use it.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hurd.
Representative Barnhart, so just point of clarification. So it's simply would mandate that we put in the conduit and the wire, or just the conduit?
Conduit.
Conduit only.
Conduit and the service. And service, of course, is the switch panel and the access to electricity back in the electrical room.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate you introducing this bill for us this morning. An interesting concept. And we have a few others, I think, that... are ready to testify, Zach Hinken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I thought I had someone else, but...
Good morning, Chair and committee members. Hope you had a sunny weekend as I did. I'm Zach Hinken from Oregon City, and I'm speaking on behalf of Drive Oregon in support of House Bill 2577. Would like to make two points with the bill, at least the way I'm approaching it. And then one is that it is inexpensive, and two, that it helps inform the market for people that would consider this or are considering this and are looking for direction. So over the last year, I have worked with various condo associations on with them as they're considering infrastructure upgrades, parking lot upgrades, and it's hard. It's expensive, and even when they're grappling with the cost of the actual charging station, the bulk of the project is usually the service panel, the conduit, and the wiring. Each situation is different. There's different parking lot levels. Usually what it comes out to is you are either given the choice of a very expensive project or a project that isn't going to serve their customer the best, because you are stuck with having it you know, in the dark recesses of a parking lot or something like that. It's challenging. As Representative Barnhart said, the conduit is cheap. It's very cheap. Recent interaction with a developer working on a project, Haslow and Ninth at the Lloyd District. Since they're doing a fresh build, as they're considering items that are going to complement the sustainability of their new building, installing charging stations is going to be a given for them, but installing the extra conduit along the way, it's also very helpful. I can't stress enough the need for sizing the panel correctly from the get-go, because if you put in a panel, the service panel, it's already a very expensive item, but going from a regular panel to one that's just a size up, it could be a small of a cost is $50 to $100. If you don't do it right the first time, you're losing that entire cost. So installing all these upgrades at the right time, it also allows them to take advantage of whatever applicable tax credits might be available to help with the project. Another instance recently that I worked with TriMet as they were planning for the charging at their Milwaukee Park and Ride that's going to support the new light rail. They were considering charging for that structure, which houses 300 parking spaces. They know they want to put charging in, but they didn't know how many. They didn't know how many charging stations by themselves, but also how many to plumb for the future. A bill like this would help inform them of such, because we'd say 20% planning done. We can put in whatever charging stations we can afford now for the project cost, but for the rest of it, it makes it a lot easier, and that's going to save them time and money. Lastly, I'm a happy, my wife and I are happy Chevy Spark EV owners, and as we plan a charging station for our house, service panel was super important. And I know while it doesn't directly apply, because it wouldn't, this bill wouldn't apply to us, but if we were not able to fit that charging station on our service panel, we wouldn't have gone through with the installation. And I think there are cases of parking lot owners where they're going to see a cost like that, and if it doesn't pencil, it's not going to happen. That is it. I would be happy to have any of your questions.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These charging stations, are they just 120 volt, and how many amps do they?
That is a good question. Predominantly, they're either 120 or 240 volts, and so you can plan for either. It will vary the amount of time it takes to charge a car. So, for instance, my car, it would the 240 volts would charge it from empty in about 4 to 6 hours, while the 120 volts would be more like 6 to 9.
Do you know how many amps, how big a breaker you need for that?
Usually the 120 volt is about 15 amps, and the 240 is 30 to 45.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2577?
Yes.
Oh, I knew we might have someone out there.
Whoa.
You'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
I shall.
Good morning.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Esmond. I am a lobbyist for the IBW Local 48 in Portland, Oregon. Have been an electrician for about 28 years. Did an apprenticeship and everything else. There's a lot of pieces to this that need to be looked at. There's a difference between 240 and 480. Most houses don't have 480. They won't have it. A little background. I was part of what they call a REACH committee. I was appointed by the governor, or maybe Mark Long. It's been a number of years to look how we can become more green in the future. What do we want to look at for 2015, 2020? So this is one of the ideas. It was lots of ideas. That being said, and for full disclosure, I'm on the board member at Drive Oregon. I'm in the electron business, so it's natural I'll gravitate there. But in the electrical code, which you're probably not familiar with, it's what we call our Bible, and it's about this thick. And this is what's nationally is used for installations. It takes 3 to 4 years to get any kind of a code change there, at the minimum, when new technology comes up. So I am going to echo what Representative Barnhart said. Let's do a pilot project and see where it goes and make sure we have people from the home builders, AGC, architects, designers, and building officials, etc. That's my idea. So a little bit of information.
Thank you. Appreciate the information.
Oh, by the way, we have 10 charging stations at our facilities, 9 220s and 1 480. Representative, you can stop by. A lot of times you can use a credit card, and that's how you pay for that.
How would Representative Barnhart pay for it if he visits your facility?
Probably with a credit card.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure he's
no pro bonos
he shows up prepared. Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So the 15-amp, 120 volts, 15-amp breaker, I mean, that's pretty standard. Is there something special?
No.
That's it.
And
GFI maybe?
Probably the whole service has a GFI or an arc fault breaker. I think it's too far into the weeds.
So nothing.
And a 220 is like a receptacle for a dryer. A 480 charge is like having those heart shockers on your chest. It's about a half hour to charge, and it's boom, a lot of amperage, big draw.
Thank you, Joe. We'll leave the details of building it to you. So with that, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart, you have something to add?
10 seconds, if I could.
Okay. Representative Kinnemer, start the clock.
Again, it's Joe Barnhart. I want to note that I've put in OLIS under this bill today a document for additional reading on electric vehicle charging. It will go into a great deal more detail in answers to Representative Barreto's questions and others, both about charging devices, systems, and how people actually use them.
Great. And if you'd check in with Mr. Esmond and the Building Codes Division, Mark Long, I see he's interested in listening, and see what else we can put together for this. It's an intriguing idea, something I think that we should be looking forward at. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. And since he's apparently not going to testify, I'd like to add a couple of comments about that.
Okay, 10 more seconds.
He has told me that he is working with some of the municipalities in Oregon in the process of establishing pilot projects, partly, I think, because I've goaded him with this bill. He, of course,
his eyes are rolling.
He may
tell you.
His mind and decide to talk now that I've called him out on it.
I bet it takes more than that to get him up here.
I have to say that I'm very pleased with the cooperation of the Building Codes Division as we move ahead with this effort.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
I appreciate it. Seeing no one else wanting to testify, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2577. And we're going to go back to the bill that we carried over from Friday. That'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2764. Jan, can you remind us what this bill does?
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. This is a bill that modifies the attorney fees, claimant fees, when workers' compensation cases. Specifics being that it requires interest payment on compensable benefits, attorney fees, penalties, and costs that are withheld pending an appeal. It allows attorney fees under certain circumstances for the representation related to or before a managed care organization or the director of DCBS. And it requires attorney fees be awarded equal in relation to the fees earned by attorneys for the insurers or the self-insurers. And it directs the board to increase attorney fees biannually by the same rate of increase in the average weekly wage. It declares an emergency, and there was a proposed -1 amendment that said that rather than the board increasing the fees annually, instead they will review the attorney fees biannually.
Thank you. Betsy Earls. And John Clore. No John Clore.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Judge Burrows representing Associated Oregon Industries. And I apologize. Mr. Clore was coming down from Portland this morning. Hope to be here by 8:30.
Okay. We'll watch.
Perhaps you'll have time to hear from him when he gets here. And just I'll just put this on the record now, but AOI is appearing before you this morning in opposition to House Bill 2764 for a number of reasons. Prior to the workers' comp reforms of 1990, attorney's fees and administrative costs were eating up a large portion of the money in the workers' compensation system. So that by the time of the Mahonia Hall conversations or meetings, injured worker benefits in Oregon were among the lowest in the nation, and employer premiums were among the highest. I think my understanding is that the main success of the 1990 reforms was to cut out most of those ancillary costs, making the injured worker the main beneficiary of this new system. The evidence of this success has shown up year after year in better worker benefits and more reasonable premiums than almost anywhere else in the country. AOI is concerned that House Bill 2764, as it's currently written, will erode that progress and open the door to costs that won't necessarily benefit injured workers. AOI is a strong proponent of the valuable role that MLAC has played since the 1990 reforms. And as I know you heard on Friday, MLAC has asked us to work with the proponents of House Bill 2764 to find some common ground. We have a meeting that is scheduled for tomorrow. To work on the bill with the proponents. So I think rather than get too far into the details of what's wrong with the bill for today, I would like to defer further testimony on it until we've gotten through that process. We are hoping to have a good conversation tomorrow. It may not be our last conversation on the bill and one that AOI is working on as well, and we hope to present that to MLAC beginning on Friday and bring it back to you. And with that, I could entertain questions, or I can sit here and wait for Mr. Clore. Or...
We had a pretty lively debate on Friday.
I saw that.
And any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. I appreciate it, and maybe Mr. Clore will show up before we get done.
All right, thank you.
Committee, up next, I had John Schultz. I asked the Workers' Comp Division to come up and testify a little bit about the... Oh, is Mr. Clore here? Maybe we'll have you stand down and go ahead and take Mr. Clore's testimony. Oh, no, you're right on time.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning. If you just identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm John Clore. I'm a workers' compensation defense attorney. I've been that for about 40 years in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington. My peer rating is the highest available for attorneys. I'm a former law professor at Northwestern in workers' compensation, and several years I chaired the state CLE on that subject here for the Oregon State Bar. You know, there's a... if I were here purely out of self-interest, I would be testifying in favor of this bill. There's a joke. One lawyer in town starves, two thrive. When I first started off, I represented injured workers and labor unions, and I got to know an older defense attorney, and he said, he who sues my client is my brother. So, you know, I'm here testifying in part against my brothers. But I think that, you know, my self-interest in this bill would be that if you pass it, it will increase the business for defense attorneys like myself. So I think one of the things is I've been doing this long enough, and you brought this up in the hearing on Friday about the Mahonia Hall. And, you know, so I've witnessed the system before and after the reforms. And I can honestly say that when I compare the experience in Oregon following the reforms with my practice in Washington, I can see the manifest difference because of the balance in the system. And I think the balance is primarily because of the institution of IMLAC and the Mahonia Hall reforms. I think the basic premise for those reforms were that the bar was raised to get into the system, and correspondingly, benefits were raised to the people in the system. Before those reforms, our state was among the highest in cost of doing business and among the lowest in delivery of benefits to the injured workers. Since then, that's been reversed, and it's been reversed on a constant basis. When I listened to the testimony, I didn't hear any real data that supported the idea or the notion that injured workers are somehow underrepresented. I think that if you look at the statistics for the past 25 years, that's been above 90% representation for injured workers. The number of attorneys in the field, defense and plaintiff, have remained relatively constant throughout that period of time. The talk about the graying of the bars, I think that's true for on both sides of the bar. Workers' compensation is not exactly a sexy practice of law for people to get into. It's difficult for us to retain young lawyers on our side of the business as well. It's contentious, and a lot of people just don't like it. So to say that because that somehow the system prevents these people or injured workers from getting adequate representation, I don't think bears scrutiny. There's a part of the bill, it's not all just about workers' compensation. There's a very fundamental portion of it that shifts the balance of power, or shifts the burden of proof, not the balance of power. That's incorrect. The amendment that's proposed to ORA 656012 talks about that the law shall, that is a catchword in law, shall be interpreted to allow benefits if there's a reasonable reading of the law. What that means is that novel legal principles without any bearing and precedent will be allowed or shall be allowed if there's some reasonable interpretation that can be given to them. One of the marks of IMLAC and Mahonia Hall was balance. That will create an imbalance. So I think that that's a very novel and unprecedented shift. Plus, what is a reasonable reading of the law? That's a big hole. That's big enough for the Ohio State running back to run through in the title game. A reasonable reading of the law is so big that it could be interpreted to mean anything. And I think fundamentally what this bill does is it increases the incentive for litigation. It removes the caps. Let me give you an example. In the state of Washington, claimants' lawyers are only paid out of increased benefits. There is no cap to those benefits. So we see time and time again practicing lawyers maintaining people on time loss artificially longer than they should be because they're continuing to get a slice of that pie. The way you retire in the state of Washington is you work for 20, 25 years and you build a closet full of pension cases and you get paid on those for the lifetime of the pensions. There is an example, and litigation is far more expensive up there, far more litigious. There's no assessed fees. They all get it out of compensation. And Oregon is far more fair in that sense because up there, the claimants pay for their own witnesses. Here, if they want to take a deposition, we pay. Here, if we deny a claim and we're wrong, we pay them an assessed fee. That's not true up there. A claimant's lawyer can litigate a denied claim in Washington and get nothing, only for the hope that it's going to be open and they're going to get the benefits down the line. That's a difference between the two systems. I think eliminating caps on fees is wrong because I think it's going to increase the idea that we can litigate a $5 penalty and get a $5,000 fee. So what this will do is it will increase my business. I'll get more money. Guys like me will make more money. Law firms like me will have more litigation. You know, there was some testimony about the disparity between the fees between claimants' lawyers and defense attorneys. Let's think about this for a minute. Claimants' firms generally do Social Security disability income. Those fees aren't reflected. Claimants' attorneys also do personal injury, PI. That's not reflected in the fees. Most defense attorneys, on the numbers that you're looking at, are either in-house lawyers for an insurance company or SAFE, or people like me who specialize in doing nothing but defense work. I have no other source of income. So if you compare the fact that you're comparing what claimants' lawyers get in the state of Oregon versus what defense lawyers get, it's apples and oranges. It's not like that's all they do. So I think that's something you should be aware of. And I noticed a comment by my colleague Jody Phillips Polich about how they don't get paid for helping people because it's not part of the fee structure. That happens on our side. People call up and say, hey, John, what do you think about this? I don't charge it. It's called service. There is no state in the union that I'm aware of that doesn't have some restrictions on how you pay injured workers' attorneys in the system. So to say, well, the law won't allow them to pay us, well, the law won't allow them to pay them in Washington for the same thing. So that's the situation. We've had 25 years of a very balanced system. I know IMLAC is going to vet this week. I think the 3rd they're going to meet on it. Urge you to wait. Let that process take care of itself. I realize we have new people on IMLAC, but we need to keep that institution going and keep the memory alive of why we have it, because it creates a balance in the system. So in summary, this bill will make it easier for claimants' attorneys to prevail. It will increase their fees. It will increase their incentive to file litigation on minimal issues, and it'll increase my business. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
Of the workers' comp claims in Oregon, how many of them are actually litigated?
I don't have that detail, but...
Because I don't know is this a problem looking for a solution or...
I'm sorry.
Or is this a solution looking for a problem or a problem looking for a solution? So if anybody out there has the idea of how many actually go to litigation, I think that would help.
I think that is part of the data that you can go on the DCBS website. They've got annual updates on that, and you can see how many cases were denied and how many cases were litigated. But my sense is the numbers have remained the same for 25 years in terms of the percentages.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kinnear.
No, I just pointing.
You were interrupting me there.
I'm sorry.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, in response to Representative Doherty's question, I did ask that on Friday, and out of the 35,000 claims, I think, this is from SAFE, there were approximately 2,400, I think, that were litigated. It's the early, or 2,200 to 2,400.
Thank you.
That sounds about right.
10%. Representative
House. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony was interesting. I'm curious about a situation where a worker wants to be represented, their claim's been denied, they succeed, and now if I retain Representative Fagan, I've got to pay her out of my settlement, right, and reduce the what I would have had, basically.
That depends on the kind of case you have. If you have a fully accepted claim and it's an issue about amount of compensation you're going to get, then her fees are going to come out of the compensation that she gets of an increase for you. If it's a matter of a denied claim and she prevails on overturning that denial, she will be paid a fee in addition to any compensation you receive. It's called an assessed fee.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony and coming down this morning.
Thank you very much.
And I did get a note from Art Towers. Did you have someone else that was going to testify, or were you testifying this morning?
We'll go after Mr. Schultz.
Okay, that's fine. John Schultz. Thank you. Committee, I ask the Workers' Comp Division to kind of give us a little bit of background around House Bill 2764 while we were examining this issue. So thank you for being here this morning. Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We prepared an overview of workers' compensation generally, and then going to the bill here at the end. So hopefully I can shed some light on some things. So what is workers' compensation, just basically? Well, workers' compensation is an insurance program. Some call it a social insurance program that protects employers and workers from financial loss and hardship due to on-the-job injuries. It's based on a compromise where employees are guaranteed medical and disability or wage replacement benefits, and employers are protected from lawsuits. Oregon's history of workers' compensation starts back around the turn of the previous century. Before 1913, in fact, the only recourse for workers who were injured or killed on the job was to sue their employer for the workplace injuries. The legislature created the workers' compensation system in 1914, and employers were required at that time to purchase insurance through a state fund. At first, it was employers in high-risk industries only. There's policy findings embedded in the workers' compensation law, and you've heard about some of the objectives, which are also part of the policy statement, but I wanted to touch on just a couple of the basic policy statements I think are important. The legislature has found that for Oregon, that injuries do and will occur at work, that Oregon's economic enterprise and employees work is a valuable Oregon resource. Lawsuits are costly, and they have low benefit for both parties. An exclusive statutory system of compensation would provide the best solution, and a part of workers' compensation that's worth bringing up is that the costs of workers' compensation are just passed along to the consumers of the goods and services of Oregon employees. So in essence, Oregon employers, in essence, we all pay for the system. Couple of things that are earmarks of just about any workers' compensation system, and these are true in Oregon, is that most workers in Oregon are covered. If they're not covered by the Oregon workers' compensation system, they're typically covered by a federal system or longshore and harbor acts. It's a no-fault system. Workers or employers don't have to prove fault or negligence, unlike in a tort situation. Workers' compensation provides an exclusive remedy. Employers are protected from lawsuits, as I've mentioned. There's comprehensive benefits provided, medical care, payment for wage loss and disability. Workplace safety is encouraged, and an administrative-level problem-solving or dispute system is part of the Oregon system, which is a little bit different than a lot of other systems. But most systems look towards an efficient way to resolve their disputes. Just pointing out quickly, the system we have today in Oregon, some people call it a three-way system, was created in 1966, and all that means is that employers could buy their workers' compensation coverage from private insurers, the state fund, Safe Corporation, or they could self-insure. You heard about reform efforts. Really, the reform era in Oregon was between 1987 and 2001, where there were a number of efforts to reform the system by the legislature. Some of the results you've heard about, I'll just touch quickly on some that you haven't heard much about, too. Those reform efforts put the focus or the emphasis on getting the workers back to work. There were improvements in safety and enforcement of the law. Managed care was created for Oregon workers' compensation system. There was a much more precise definition of what a compensable injury is, and there were, as you've heard, streamlining the litigation and dispute processes. On this last point, the bill before you, one of the big changes during this time was to divide up the kinds of disputes coming through the system. Previously, disputes went to the hearings division of the Workers' Compensation Board, and some of the changes were that some disputes were delegated to the Workers' Compensation Division at the first level for an administrative process. Remaining disputes continue to go through the board. Our system today, what do we get for the efforts that we put into the system? Well, after 14 years of reform, we have one of the most affordable systems for employers in the nation. We have the ninth lowest premiums in the nation for employers here in Oregon. The benefits for workers have definitely been strengthened. In fact, they're strong as compared to other states. An example of that would be wage loss replacement. 80% of the states pay lower wage loss replacement benefits than Oregon does at this time. The legislature, of course, plays the key role in the system. You decide who must be covered and who must provide coverage. You set benefit levels. Generally, you decide who qualifies for benefits. You provide policy direction to those of us who work in the system. Where I work, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, our role is to regulate the system. We, in the Workers' Compensation Division, make certain that employers are providing insurance or coverage, first of all, and we ensure that injured workers receive the benefits that they are due. The Insurance Division monitors the performance of insurance companies in subjects like solvency, rates, forms, etc. Oregon OSHA enforces workplace safety. The Workers' Compensation Board serves the role, the important role, and a lot of what's before you in this bill of resolving disputes in the system. The board conducts hearings, mediations, reviews appeals, approves settlements. The Management Labor Advisory Committee that you've heard about, there's five representatives. Well, first of all, it's a statutory committee that was created by the legislature during the reform era. There's five representatives each from business and labor. These represent the two main customers of the workers' compensation system, workers and management. They're appointed by the governor, they're confirmed by the Senate, they're charged by law to study issues that affect the workers' compensation system. The committee reports its findings and makes recommendations to the legislature and the governor. They provide a forum for employers and employees, as well as other stakeholders, to discuss issues related to the workers' comp. It provides an opportunity to really vet some of those issues and reach consensus on recommendations for statutory changes that are designed to improve our system. In the past, the legislature has also asked MLAC directly to review specific issues. We have ombudsmen both for injured workers as well as small business. The Ombudsman for Injured Workers advocates for workers' benefits and rights. They're a resource to workers and their attorneys. The Small Business Ombudsman helps employers navigate the system, find workers' compensation coverage, helps them with their classification of insurance, which leads to cost. We also have both insurers and self-insured employers who are responsible to process the claims, pay the benefits, rate permanent disability. They set aside reserves to pay for future liabilities. They provide safety directly programs, and they implement our return to work system. Now, you heard a lot on Friday, and you saw a copy of this chart from Mr. Towers on Friday. We've provided you another copy for this meeting. You heard how complex the system can be for workers. This is true, especially for workers who have complex medical claims or disability claims or are finding themselves on the border of some of the decision-making issues. This is a graphic of our dispute system. You have a copy of this in your materials. I won't go over it in detail other than to say there are lots of opportunities for disputes to arise in the workers' compensation system. Remember, workers' compensation replaces a tort litigation system. It's a substitute remedy for a litigation system. Sometimes workers do need attorneys. One of the system's objectives is to keep disputes resolved at the lowest level possible and as quickly as possible, and there's dispute resolution processes in place where I work at the Workers' Compensation Division, which is at administrative level, in the Hearings Division of the Workers' Compensation Board, as well as at the board level themselves for appeals, and ultimately disputes go to the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court if they're not resolved at a lower level. Those do happen, although not a lot. Claim and attorney fees. The bill before you, HB 2764, is all about this. In Oregon, the attorneys may not charge a worker for their services directly. They are only paid attorney fees when a representative worker prevails in certain disputes currently. Examples of those types of fees are in the slide before you, reversing a denial by the insurance company, obtaining an increase in compensation, preventing a decrease, negotiating settlements are all areas where fees can be provided. Those are just examples. There's two types of fees in Oregon. There's out-of-compensation fees as well as assessed fees. Out-of-compensation fees are paid out of the worker's award or settlement. They're usually a percentage of the award or settlement, and they're usually for a settlement or a disability benefit increase. Settlements are the largest source of out-of-compensation fees in the workers' compensation system. About 70% of claimant attorney fees today are paid out of the workers' compensation. Assessed fees are paid by the insurer in addition to compensation due to the worker. So, in other words, that the attorney fee does not reduce the benefits going to the worker. They're not based on a percentage, but on the decision maker's judgment of a reasonable fee for the attorney. Overturning denials is the biggest source of assessed fees in the system. Over the past few years, about 30% of all claimant attorney fees in Oregon were assessed fees. A little bit of recent history on attorney fees. This is an issue that does come up. So in 1999, that was the last time that the Workers' Compensation Board adjusted their out-of-compensation fees. Then between 2003 and 2009, the legislature took action to add new attorney fees. There's a few examples of that in the slide. Can I answer any questions? I'd be happy to.
Questions? Representative Fagan.
So I'm interested to learn more about the Office of the Ombudsman. How many ombudsmen do you have in the system as a whole?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, in the small business ombudsman, there's two staff, the ombudsman and an assistant ombudsman. And with the injured worker ombudsman, there is a single ombudsman, as well as I'm thinking, and I might have this a little wrong, it's I believe six assistant ombudsmen who work for the injured worker ombudsman. So about six or seven people who respond to inquiries or need for advocacy.
So and when you're talking about people that are there to advocate for the injured worker, there's seven people statewide. That's it. One person and six assistants.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, that's correct.
Okay. Quick follow-up. So you talked about out-of-compensation fees and assessed fees for claimants' attorneys. Can you talk a little bit about how defense attorneys, where does that come from? Is there any kind of, what are the rules around paying for the defense attorneys?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fagan, typically the fees for defense attorneys are paid by their clients, and it can be for litigation that has occurred. It can be for no litigation. It can be for advice that's provided in-house. And things differ, and I think the last witness, Mr. Klor, talked about that. Some attorneys work in-house for insurance companies or self-insured employers. My guess is they're being paid on a salary basis, as well as then there are independent attorneys who stand apart from that, who are hired by those firms. And beyond that, that starts to get beyond my level of competence to answer how those fees are negotiated.
Mostly just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you, John. I appreciate that. I think, still, I fundamentally just have a difficult time when we keep using the word balance, and this bill is about fees, and yet for people who actually help the injured workers, there's all of these caps and restrictions. There's seven people within the system who can actually help injured workers versus, within Safe Corporation, within the system as a whole, people who are actually representing the insurance company, there's numerous and there's no caps. And so, even the previous testimony talked about how, the defense attorneys, they do this as their entire career and the claimant's attorneys don't. And to me, that kind of proves the need for this bill, because you can't even make a living doing this as a claimant's attorney, whereas defense attorneys, that's their entire career. And so to me, that actually kind of proves the need for the bill. So I don't necessarily, it's not so much a question, just, we keep throwing around this word balance, and yet when it comes to fees, it's all imbalanced in favor of the defense. It appears to me, at least. I don't necessarily expect you to comment on that, but thank you.
You're welcome.
So just to clarify, when you said the small business ombudsman, there was two with no assistance?
Mr. Chair, I probably misspoke. There's one ombudsman and a second assistant ombudsman for assisting employers.
Okay. Ripson Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With seven ombudsmen that are there, because, I mean, listening to the process and how things are laid out, I actually seems like it is a pretty good system. But I'm just wondering, how busy are the ombudsmen? I mean, are they not getting back to people in time or taking care of issues in a timely manner? Do we need more? How do you see that situation, or is it something you need to get back to us on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, the ombudsman's office stays pretty busy. They get, I don't know how many calls per day, and I can get back to the committee on that, but they get a lot of telephone calls from injured workers, as well as other players or stakeholders within the system that they're interacting with. And when they're adopting their advocacy role, they're reaching out a lot of times to claims adjusters, either through the insurance companies or self-insured employers, and asking for, they're advocating on behalf of an injured worker who has an issue going on something. My own observation is the ombudsman's office is a very busy place.
Sam Barreto.
Mr. Chair, when we talk about the attorneys that represent the employers, and if you include fraud into that, do they also defend in the fraud cases too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto, yes, attorneys on both sides of the employer attorneys as well as worker attorneys would be defending their clients, typically in terms of fraud allegations.
Okay.
I'm curious, do you have statistics on what percentage of workers are actually represented by legal counsel?
Mr. Chair, I would need to get back to you on that. I heard Representative Doherty's question and was trying to do some fast math based on some different charts that we have in terms of how many represented workers are involved in disputes, and I can pull numbers together, but I don't have those ready to go.
I think from the testimony we heard, it sounds like the insurer has attorneys on just about all their cases. It seems like they have in-house people that are preparing those worker comp claims, and the process being very complex and full of disputes, the testimony that we've heard is that the workers have a hard time getting attorneys to take these cases because of the ability for the attorneys to get paid once and the availability of those attorneys as a result of that. And so I think that's a really important question when we talk about balance, you know, who's got representation and who doesn't. And, we also heard testimony that workers usually don't get representation until, way into the process. Which is a little bit disturbing, because if the system is full of disputes and is very complex, and they have their cases denied, or initially when you file a comp claim and it gets denied, you're all of a sudden in a dispute just right off the bat. And so I'm trying to balance the conversations that we've heard about this and how the system has not kept up with making sure that workers do have representation. Seems like a fundamental issue that hasn't really changed for quite some time. So I'd be interested in some of those statistics if you can get something like that, if it's available. Don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will look at the data that we do have and try to provide you data quickly and on those issues.
Thank you. And my last note was Arthur Towers. Were you signed up or not signed up? Or okay, you do were.
No, we're not.
He was, but you're not.
Right.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Chairman Holby, members of the committee. My name is Randy Elmer. I'm an attorney here in Salem. I'm a workers' compensation attorney. I've been representing claimants for about 32 years in the work comp system. I'd say conservatively 65 to 70% of my practice that entire time has been representing injured workers. The first thing I'd like to talk to you about today is I keep hearing testimony about the sky is going to fall if this bill passed because it may have a huge economic impact. And I would like to draw your attention to the most recent comprehensive report that was put together by the Workers' Compensation Division. That's the 2012 report on the Oregon Workers' Compensation System. And so you won't have to take my word on this. I'm going to cite you to the page where you will find the information I'm about to give you. In this report for 2011 is the latest statistics. On page 9, they tell us that the workers' compensation total system written premiums in Oregon totaled $813 million. So imagine our overall pie of 100% of this pie is $813 million. If we turn then to page 8 of this report, it tells us that claimant attorney's fees totaled $21.3 million in 2011. 67% of these fees were taken out of claims disposition agreements and disputed claim settlements. Insurer defense legal costs totaled $36 million. So we take our big 813 and we take those total numbers of fees on both sides, we got 7% of that pie. And then of that, there's only 35% that's claimants' attorney's fees of that little 7% slice. And 70% of that little slice we aren't talking about in this bill, okay? So we're talking about 6.39% of that 7% slice at most. And even if that amount doubled, it wouldn't have a huge impact. But the effect that it has on the injured workers and incentivizing both lawyers to represent injured workers and claims adjusters to process claims correctly is huge. Let me give you an example. You've heard about the disputes about time loss. We frequently see these in our practice. I would say at least 35% of the cases I see, my client says to me, how come I'm not getting a full two-thirds of the average weekly wage I was earning? They seem to have forgotten that I worked overtime. They seem to forget that I worked with a non-discretionary bonuses or that I had differential pay because I'm a union worker and I work swing shifts and graveyard shifts. So we request a hearing. And then we prepare all of the information that it takes to go to that hearing and prove that the wage base includes all these other dollars that were paid to this worker. Now, it takes quite a bit of work to get that put together and to present that kind of a case, no matter how big or how small the outcome. And whether I get my client $5 in additional benefits per week or $50, my fee is going to be capped at $1,500, regardless of the effort I put into proving that point. And then my client has to give me that $1,500 out of the money that he was entitled to begin with. This bill would incentivize claims adjusters to scrutinize those claims a little more carefully and make sure that they don't just take information they may receive on the 801 claim form that has a portion for the employer to fill out, where I frequently see the employer says, my worker made so many dollars per hour, 40 hours a week. The claims adjuster takes that information at face value and starts issuing checks accordingly. And then my client says, but that's not true. I didn't work a 40-hour week, and we get into these disputes. So one of the beauties of this bill is that it's going to incentivize insurers to do the right thing, and we've never heard a bit of testimony here in opposition to this bill that if they do the right thing and there's no need for a hearing, that fees will go up, because it won't. Now, the second thing I wanted to point out about this bill is the point that Mr. Klor made about claimants' lawyers do have other aspects to their practice, which is true. I could not practice workers' compensation if that's the only area of law I practiced. I do subsidize my practice with a few personal injury cases and Social Security disability cases, because if I didn't do that, I couldn't pay my salaries and my rent and keep my practice going. It just wouldn't work. The third thing I want to make a point about is one of the things this bill addresses is paying us where we don't get paid. And I think this is an important aspect of the bill that I hope you would give serious consideration to. And I'd like to give you another example. If I go to a hearing and I prove compensability of a claim, then I am given a fee, awarded a fee by the judge in that case called an assess fee. It means he's assessed the fee to be paid by the insurer to me for prevailing. As it currently stands, there's a huge incentive for the insurer to appeal my fee, and I'll tell you why. because they don't pay interest. My fee can be pending appeal for the next 8 months in front of the work comp board, and they won't pay a dime of interest for challenging that fee. I defend that fee. I won't get paid one dime of extra attorney's fees for the time it takes to write the briefs and the written arguments before the workers' compensation board to defend that fee. And then they may go to the Court of Appeals, and it's going to sit at the Court of Appeals for another 1 year. And again, no penalties, or no interest, and no attorney's fees. And the brief writing at the Court of Appeals for the lawyers on this panel, as they know, is a huge effort. And I'll tell you what sometimes happens. We get right to the point of oral argument, and the insurer withdraws their appeal. And for all that effort to get to that point, we will not be paid. But to pick up on the point that Mr. Clore made, they will be paid.
Right.
He was saying in one example, well, we shouldn't have to pay a whole lot of fees to claimants' attorneys if they get a $5 benefit. We shouldn't pay a $5,000 fee. I can assure you the defense lawyer billed $5,000, and he got paid his fee, win or lose. We're trying to even up the playing field a little bit, but as I explained in my initial remarks, this is not going to make a huge impact on the system because we're talking about such a small piece of the overall pie. So I thank you very much for allowing me to testify this morning. And I'm happy to take any questions if you have any. Otherwise, we'll turn the time over to Mr. Semple.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Keith Semple. I'm an attorney in Eugene, Oregon. I've been doing workers' compensation practice for about 11 years now. I would say that probably about 80% of my practice in that time has been workers' compensation. I'm also the current chair of the Oregon State Bar Workers' Compensation Section. I'm not speaking in my capacity as chair of the workers' comp section today, but I thought it might be relevant to my involvement in the workers' compensation system. I would like to talk to you about kind of the basic economic aspects of this, and we've talked and you've heard a number of times that defense fees are not regulated in any way, shape, or form. Claimants' attorneys' fees are regulated, and we do not have the ability to go to our clients or have our clients come to us and offer us money in exchange for our time and efforts in representing them with regard to their claim. And part of the reason for that is to protect injured workers from unscrupulous attorneys. The other part is an effort to contain costs, as we've heard. That's different for the insurers. They can charge whatever they want, with the exception of that it must be reasonable under the ethical rules. So they can take any client they want, they can charge by the hour, and they get paid win, lose, or draw. We've heard a lot about the idea that the outcomes in the system are balanced and fair and good for the worker. While I might disagree with that, you've heard from the insurers that they feel that the balance is a good one in this system and that current outcomes are, sounds like, satisfactory more or less to the insurance defense. The issue is that it costs them $16 million more per year to obtain those outcomes than injured workers are being given to obtain the same outcomes. Injured workers need more money to pay their attorneys. I can tell you with 100% sincerity, in the 11 years that I've been in the bar, when I got into the workers' compensation bar, I could count on one hand the number of attorneys who had maybe 10 years more experience than I have. And I can count on one hand the number of attorneys who've come in to the claimant's bar in the last 10 years to replace some of these attorneys who are, as we've seen, graying and nearing retirement age. We've talked a little bit about the statistics on representation, and I see that it's tempting to use that as a proxy for whether workers are currently unrepresented. The important thing to keep in mind is that when a worker comes into the office, the attorney decides, more or less on a sliding scale, how much risk am I taking? Am I actually going to earn a fee on this matter? Is the amount of the benefit in question enough to justify a fee? And if they come in with a $100 issue or a $500 issue in time loss, my fee is 25% of that, Those workers, you know, that's just not feasible if that's the only issue. Those workers, I can almost assure you, are being turned away. You could talk to the ombudsperson about that. I do frequently. Those types of disputes are the ones that workers are going to have a hard time obtaining an attorney for, because there's just no compensation for the attorney to get involved. And those workers, I almost assure you, are going away. They are not reflected in the statistics of unrepresented workers because they are not confident enough to pursue their claim through this complex system. They're just going away. They're not part of that statistic. So if we're going to use that statistic as a proxy, we really need to think through that. Is that really representative of all the people who are not represented in the system? It's hard to obtain a stat for that. You're going to hear a lot of anecdotal evidence on that because that's more or less all there is to really get at that issue of whether people are unrepresented. You know, I would say that that when claimants are seeking more benefits, it may cost a little bit more in the system, but you have to look at their benefits. It seems like a dirty word when we talk about claimants seeking benefits, that attorneys are going to get involved and seek benefits for claimants. But the insurers decide on their own how early to get an attorney involved. They have claims examiners. They have claims professionals. They already have a base of knowledge that the worker doesn't have, and they're still finding the need to pay $16 million more a year in attorney fees to obtain the same outcomes. The cost of workers' compensation have plummeted since the Mahonia Hall changes. That's a good thing. But we have to look at how far the pendulum has swung for injured workers. We've got a major disparity here, and they are not in 10 years from now going to have access to representation in the way they have in the past. And that's going to have a major impact on them. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Questions from this panel? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening to all of this, and I hear and understand where you're coming from. One of the things I look at in my office, we obviously deal with constituents every day and have people sending emails and having to help them out with different issues that they're facing. And this isn't something that really rises to the top on issues that come to us. And we have MLAC that specializes in this. And I guess my question to you would be, what's the issue, or why don't you trust the process of MLAC coming up with a solution for what you're dealing with? These are a series of workers and then employers coming together, trying to solve issues and take care of things, because one of the benefits that we do have in the state of Oregon is the fact that we have a state-run system, that the rates are very low, that is enticing for businesses to locate here versus other things. And why would we want to upset the apple cart on that? Or, well, I guess in your opinion, we're not upsetting the apple cart on that, but I'm just saying, why don't you trust MLAC to come up with a viable solution?
I'll defer that to Mr. Elmer, as he's been working through this process with MLAC for what I would say maybe the last 10 years at minimum.
Well, since it was put into existence, Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, that's a good comment. And isn't that we distrust MLAC, and we are working with them? I don't want to say anything disparaging about them. But in years past, Bob Shipwreck was co-chair for labor, and Lisa Trussell was co-chair for management for a number of years. And then after that, it was the representative from Portland who's their construction company that Sherry Sundstrom. These are people, though, let me point out, that had a great deal of experience in workers' comp. And there was some continuity there in the MLAC committee. Currently, one of the co-chairs is Guy Ballou, who I've known for about 30 years. He was at EBI when I first met him. Now he's at Louisiana Pacific and works in their workers' comp department. And I've sat down with him a couple of times privately and talked. And they do business all around the United States, not so much just in Oregon. And I think it's fair to say that the current MLAC group, of which we're short three members, are very unaware of this process. They have no institutional memory about this process, and they are really scrambling to get up to speed. And that's why we haven't gotten any up or down vote from them so far, because they can't quite get assembled to the point they're ready to hear what we have to say and make an intelligent decision about it. And so this hearing was scheduled before they could even get to that. But we're going to go back and talk to them. And to the extent we can educate them and help them to make a decision, we're more than happy to do that. And to that extent, yes, we do trust the process.
Mr. Chairman, other follow-up?
Follow-up briefly?
Yeah, I guess we're still early in the session here, and they're looking at doing this. I mean, would you think it'd be, for me, I feel like it would be wise for us to sort of wait on, because I'm seeing a lot of things where you've seen employers and the union, they've negotiated something, and then the union didn't get what they want, so they're coming in here wanting us to change the law so they can get the benefit that they need. And I don't think that's a place where the legislature should be. And we have MLAC that we could be getting a result from here in a few weeks or a couple weeks. You think it'd be wise for us to wait and see what their opinion is on this before we move forward?
Well, Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, it is indeed a complex, dynamic process. And we're trying to kind of juggle the balls here, and we're trying to help make sure this committee understands this bill completely in the time that we're allowed and the opportunity that has arisen. At the same time, we are also working through the MLAC process, and we're working with the opposition to this bill. But it's all got to kind of happen all at one time, it seems to me. And I would urge no delay on this committee and what you decide to do about this bill.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony morning, gentlemen. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2764. And let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2803. Jan, will we give us a summary of this particular bill?
This is a measure that requires the OLCC to state in the order that approves a beverage container redemption center to state the services that are to be provided by the center and the equivalent services provided by the dealers that don't participate in the center. It requires OLCC to provide notice of the program requirements to each dealer that's not included in the order. It requires OLCC to inspect the premises of the dealers within the convenience zones occupying 5,000 square feet or more, but that choose not to participate in the redemption center to ensure that they comply with the requirements. Specifies that the dealer is exempt for reasons that they have fewer than 100,000 beverage containers sold and to report to OLCC the number of the containers sold. And it requires the dealer who begins business in the convenience zones after the redemption center begins operating to indicate to OLCC whether they're going to participate. It requires the OLCC to suspend the liquor license for specified durations for any violations of the program. You have before you a proposed -2 amendment, and it requires in that order that the OLCC prepares that approves a redemption center to state which dealers are served by the center and which dealers are not served or not choosing to participate. It requires the dealers within the zones but not included in the order as a dealer to comply with the program. It removes a proposed inspection of the premises by OLCC, and it modifies the duration of the liquor license suspension.
Seeming simple bill. I have Joe Gilliam signed up. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and explain to us why this bill's in front of us.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Joe Gilliam. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association, over 500 grocery stores here in Oregon that operate under the Oregon Bottle Bill Law. You thought workers' comp was fun. let's do bottle of cans. This bill before you revises the reporting requirements for OLCC and sets out a timeline of compliance for retailers who choose either to participate or not participate in redemption centers. The redemption centers are centers that we have been undergoing building because of all the legislation we've had in the last few years. Redemption center has a radius of 3.5 miles from the point of the redemption center, and all the stores in that radius then are
can decide to whether to be in or be out. And if you're in, you get to quit redeeming bottles and cans, and they all go to the redemption center. They've been highly successful over the last few years. If you're participating, that means you're getting rid of your bottles and cans, you're paying into the system, you're helping fund the cost of the system. If you're non-participating, the law requires that you can do that. You have that choice under the law, but then you have to provide equivalent services. So you have similar costs as the redemption center because you're providing the same services that are available at the redemption center. If you're non-participating and non-compliant, what you've said is we're not going to participate and we're going to ignore the law. We're just not going to do anything. We're not going to pay our fair share of the burden. So those are kind of the four main areas that this bill addresses. In 2007, we expanded the bottle bill. We added water, flavored water, increased the volume. As part of that, we had to start looking at how we increased our capacity to take in those bottles and cans for folks. In 2011, the legislature approved a pilot project, which is the redemption centers, and how they would work, the zones they had, and kind of the operating. It also set in a 80% redemption rate trigger, and if we stayed below that over a two-year period, the bottles and cans would go to a dime. It also included that there would be expansion no later than 2018, which would then include pretty much the rest of the beverages you see out there, the energy drinks, the Gatorades, the sports drinks, teas, those types of things that aren't in the bottle bill today. In 2013, you passed Senate Bill 117, and that codified the pilot project that we had for the redemption centers. It was very successful, and they said, go ahead and go forth and do more of them. It also clarified some language in the bill for non-participating retailers. Instead of having to provide similar services, they now have to provide equivalent services, and that was a stronger legal verbiage to be very clear that you have to do what the redemption centers are doing. So in our current status, we are now, over all this legislation, we are building these redemption centers. And by 2018, we need to build enough that they'll handle no less than 60% of what is coming through the system. To give you an idea of the scope out there, 300 grocery stores handle 70% of the volume that comes through the state prior to all this legislation. So even though there's 3,000 locations where you can return bottles and cans, 300 to 70% gives you an idea. When you pick up a six-pack at 7-Eleven, that's not where you return your cans. You put them in your bag, and then on Saturday, you're down at Fred Meyer's returning your cans, and that's it just works that way. So it's a highly concentrated. We redeem far more than we sell, so it is a big deal in terms of expansion and these types of things. We currently have 11 redemption centers up and running, and they've been very successful, very well accepted. We keep them as clean as we possibly can. They're much better experience than going to one of our bottle rooms. They're well lit. They're fully staffed. There's help there and assistance, and we have high-speed counting equipment. We also do hand counting, and we have a bag drop-off. So you can put your bottles and cans in bags, sign up for an account. All you got to do is drop them off at a 24-hour door. You drop them, and they go on account. And you can get your money either at the redemption center, or you can go to the grocery store, and there's a kiosk in every grocery store that's participating. Show your card, put your PIN in, and you can get a slip for your cash. And we also run a program in some of our stores that gives them 6 cents for every bottle and can. So it's an incentive to come in and get 20% more for your bottles and cans. Give you an idea of the scope that we're looking at is the chart there on page two for you. In 2015, by the end of the year, will be about 1.1 billion containers will come through the system. 91,000 miles worth of 12-ounce cans and almost four laps around the earth, give you an idea of what the volume we're talking about. The redemption centers by the end of the year, and this is where they've been very successful in drawing people in, is by the end of the year we'll take 250 million units offline. So those stores who are participating, there's a $250 million volume they have. The redemption centers themselves will actually process 350 million. So they draw 100 million units from other places that would normally go through the grocery store process, because it's higher speed and it's easier. The bag drop-off draws all those people in. So that'll be 32% of the entire volume of the state going through these 11 centers. We hope to have 13 built by the end of the year. We are looking for properties right now to install those. We have two properties online. We're also looking in Coos Bay. We have Tigard, Albany, and we're trying to get into West Portland. It's been a little difficult finding the property. So what we process at the redemption centers is about one lap around the earth.
By 2018, that'll go up about 40%, depending on if the dime kicks in, because we don't know how much more that'll bring in, but we do know that by expanding to Gatorades and teas and all the others, we'll give about 40% increase in volume. So you're about 1.5 billion containers per year coming back to the system, about 5 laps around the Earth.
Wow.
So by 2018, the redemption centers will be doing almost what is the whole volume today. It'll be about 67% of the volume by then. The target by then is to have 23 redemption centers up and running. In total, it's 45 redemption centers to cover the state where we can put them in and make sense to do them. It'll be $66 million in investment and capital investment and $22 million a year to run it. Right now, it's $6.7 million a year to run the 11 centers the way they are. So the problem for us right now, the reason you have the bill before you, is we're on a time frame given to us by the legislature. And I'm not grousing about that or complaining about that, but it is a tight time frame to make this happen. You can see the amount of volume we have to deal with it as it's coming down the pike at us. The stores cannot handle it. So if it hits, the grocery stores will not be able to handle it, and it'll implode. So how you've set this up and what we've done over the last 7 years is very important that it gets executed. The one piece that's missing here is really the enforcement piece. And that's what's been lagging for us. So for the non-participating folks out there who want to remain non-compliant, they pretty much can do it at will. And that since 2013, when Senate Bill 117 went into effect, the last piece of legislation, has cost the participating retailers who are compliant with the law about $500,000. They're paying for their competitors who are doing nothing, sitting on the sidelines. And that is a problem. The OLCC has not responded. In 2011, when we passed the first piece of legislation, legal staff told me that they weren't comfortable enforcing the law because of the word similar services. So they said you should have used the word equivalent services. That would give us guidelines to do so. In Senate Bill 117, we did make that change from similar to equivalent, so it would be very clear. Even after doing that, we couldn't get enforcement. We filed a complaint against non-participating. It's in your packet at the end. All non-participating folks, most of them came on. A few did not and just hung out there and got a free ride in the system. We couldn't get enforcement. Just this last month, after 21 months, Walmart came on board. We're glad to have it, but it took 21 months. All we got was one letter for enforcement, no formal conclusion, no fines, no penalties, and for 21 months, it drug on. Hmm. We still have 16 Walgreens stores that have been notified, who know the law. OLCC knows they're out there, and no one's acting, and they're getting a free ride. We have 16 Dollar Tree stores in the service areas, free ride. Now, they can't have an exemption if they can show that their sales are below 100,000, that they're exempt from the law. They just need to show that and say, hey, we're out. The Walgreens can't do that. There'll be 300,000 or 400,000 units per year from a Walgreens that go to the bottle bill. With expansion coming, it'll be more than that. And they're sitting back there ignoring it. So what this bill does, it brings around guidelines and gives guidance to the OLCC to bring them in. And there's a couple things that need to happen from the process standpoint. When we approve a redemption center today, we do send out a list that says, here's who's participating. What it doesn't do is say who's not participating. It does say what services that are going to be offered, but it doesn't say what the equivalent services that need to be offered for those who choose not to participate. This bill would require that to be posted at the time that they approve the center. So it's not really a lot of extra work because you have a list of who's in and who's out. You just need to post it. 5 days after that's posted and it's approved, this bill requires the OLCC to notify the non-participating retailers, here are the services you have to provide to be compliant with the law. The retailer then has 60 days to then respond and say, here's how we're going to do it, and to prove that they're going to be in compliance with the law. In total, for a retailer, from the time we first initiate, they're going to have more than 60 days. They have about a half a year. 23 weeks is the average. By the time they're asked to be in the redemption center, they look at the cost, they make the consideration, and they decide whether they're in or out. It's about 23 weeks from end to end. So they have plenty of time to say we're in or out. They'll be telling us they're out 3 or 4 months before we even go to the OLCC for approval. So they know that they're not going to participate and have to do these pieces. So we need some kind of finality in there that says, here's your timeline. So when the redemption center opens, either they're compliant or they're not. And either they can offer services and be in the game, they can join the Redemption Center, or if they're going to ignore the law, then the OLCC has a clear timeline to put down a penalty. It also sets up a process for folks who open after Redemption Center's open. So Redemption Center's operating in Gresham, and then you open a retail store, then you have a certain amount of time period to become compliant before you open your store and start putting volume into the system that you need to take care of. Then sets up two. We're looking at the conceptual amendments, so it sets up two amendments to it. One is automatic 10-day liquor license suspension if you're non-compliant with the law or until your compliance is reached. And then you already have civil penalty authority under the law of $50 to $500 a day. That's in existing law. So if they have a someone who sells soda but does not sell beer, they couldn't suspend their license since they don't have one. So they have a civil penalty as well. I've included copies of our complaint, our letters, things we've gone through. I've personally contacted every retailer in every region. We send a FedEx. We do phone calls. We talk to each store director. And for the most part, it works. People become compliant with the law. But we do have large groups that are out there. And basically, the message has been that the bottle bill is voluntary, voluntary compliance. If we don't do anything, there won't be any enforcement. If you want us to keep this timeline and hit 2018 and build the volume, we need this bill because anybody at any time could just say, well, now I'm out on this one. I'm in, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out. Nothing's going to happen. If we don't have people following the law that we set up and what's the challenge you've given us, where our hands are tied and this thing will start to implode because someone's going to say, why am I paying for my competitor? I'm out too. Let's see what they do. They haven't done anything to them. So I'll sit in the sidelines, and then it starts falling apart. This is truly a cooperative agreement. We work with the distributors. OBRC pays for half these redemption centers. The retailers pay for the other half. We divide up the costs based on your sales into the system. So you're paying for the volume going in your system. The more retailers are in, the cheaper it gets because we're just taking about $250,000 is about the average amount, and we just keep dividing that up amongst the sales. More and more who are in, it gets cheaper and cheaper. Medford's a good example of what we have. It's one of the cheapest ones in the state, and it's below a penny because everybody's in there. Everybody's joined. And so at a cost that's usually around 2 cents per container, store level, if you're all doing it together and you're getting it below a penny, it's starting to make sense. Things are starting to work, and you can build the volume and staff the centers. So with that, I answer any questions you have on the system or the bill.
Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gilliam. A comment and a question. First, I was an opponent, would be overstating it, but a skeptic of the distribution model. I thought that it would detract from the customer convenience, etc. Watching it being implemented in Oregon City, allow me to concede publicly that you were completely right and I was wrong. You're not going to get that much this session, so take it. It really is working well in Oregon City. The customers prefer it. It's been a win-win for grocer and customer alike. My question, and you were perhaps uncharacteristically understated when talking about and naming the non-compliant participants in the system. You mentioned Walgreens, Dollar Tree. Are there any others that we should know about? I'd love to know which ones are in my district in the Oregon City Center, if for no other reason than I don't want to patronize them. But.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Barton, Walmart, Walgreens, and Dollar Tree were the largest outstanding. Mm-hmm. We have also a few grocery outlets. Mm-hmm. They're independently operated, but Redmond, Eugene, and it's in your Redmond, Eugene, and Ben still are not compliant with the law. They don't offer equivalent services, and basically, when you go into the store with a bag of cans, they just stand there and say, "We'll be right out," and then they never come back. And then they just wait and wait, and then you walk out, and you go on the Redemption Center, and you use the high-speed machines, and they go, "We dodged another bullet." So that's kind of the game that's being played out there. As long as we keep our head down, nothing's going to happen. So in Oregon City, everybody's compliant up in Oregon City. Mm-hmm. I think you might have one Walgreens up in Oregon City that is not compliant. Bacon. Safeway, Fred Meyer, Bi-Mart, Albertsons, we're all
Bacon, yeah.
Kmart was non-compliant. They're now closed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, thank you for being here. Rather an energy and environment. So, question, I mean, just to get a handle on, like, Walmart, because these are large chains that you're talking about here. The distributors, don't they collect or charge when you purchase from the distributor themselves, or they're delivering the Coke product or whatever to you? Don't you pay that nickel at that time to the distributor, and then they put it into the system?
The nickel starts at the distributor. When they deliver to our stores, you do pay the nickels. That nickel sits at OBRC now. Because of the changes in the law, OBRC is now the clearinghouse for all nickels. Because a Fred Meyer has to take back a Walmart store brand. Walmart has to take back Costco. Albertson has to take back Safeway now. It used to be all silos. So the nickels would go back and forth between each retailer and each brand. Now they're going crossways as crossfire. So you got 1.1 billion nickels fired up every year going everywhere. OBRC is the clearinghouse. So no matter where those cans are redeemed, the retailer goes there for the nickel. So if you're a non-participating retailer and you buy your case of beverages, you give your nickels to the distributor, it's an OBRC, okay, and all your stuff's going to the redemption center, that's all being squared up there. You're hands off and you don't have any costs.
I may follow up.
Follow up.
So the issue is, like, Sam's is coming out of one of their distribution centers, so they've never actually paid a nickel on that because their own trucks are bringing it in. And same thing with Walgreens and some of the other ones.
Mr. Chair, Representative Webb, no. They're compliant in their deposits. So that's a different subject. So when their distribution comes in, and if it's self-distributed, they're paying their nickels to OBRC when it comes in the state. And they're a member of that co-op, so they do that. So they're not shorting anybody any nickels that I know of. No one's had that complaint. Where they are not compliant is you have a choice when there's a redemption center in your area. You either can participate and pay part of the cost to run the center, or you can offer equivalent services to the center. So you have to set up hand counting. You have to set up a drop-off service. You have to have so many machines. So you can't just stick one machine out back and say, okay, we're compliant, and people have to stand in line, you know, at this machine, and you're not paying anything into the system. Problem is, if you're a high-volume retailer and you're putting millions, tens of millions of units into the system, and you're not paying your fair share, that's what the problem is. But it's not the nickels when they come across in the state border. It's just the cost of handling all those empty cans, and someone else is doing it for you.
Thank you. So you mentioned compliance, and I can really appreciate that compliance with our laws is sometimes difficult, and not just in this arena, but almost all of our agencies struggle sometimes having enough FTE to get proper compliance with all of the laws they're tasked with. So where does OL, I mean, because you mentioned the OLCC is sort of responsible for this, and of course there's lots of containers that aren't liquor related or alcohol related. Where do they get their money for the enforcement of this program?
Mr. Chair, they get it from whatever you tell them they have. They're general funded. They're one of the largest producers of income for the state. And they had record sales this year, so there's money there. We're not talking about a lot of manpower to go out. I've handed them a list of the people who are non-compliant in every. I do that at my cost, but I'm doing that on the benefit of my members who are participating.
So does your amendment with this increasing this to a dime have some earmarked money for OLCC in it?
Well, in our system, Mr. Chair, we pay the cost of all this handling. The nickel never gets touched.
So I said dime. Dime.
Yeah. I did say dime.
Your amendment that has the dime in it.
My amendment has the dime in it? I didn't see that amendment. But anytime you have a deposit, unless you're going to take something out of the consumer's piece, which has not been a real popular idea over the last few years, and I'm not recommending it, it's just the cost to us in the system. So we did pass a law. There was not a fiscal audit that said there is an enforcement piece to this, and it just hasn't been enforced. Now, I've sat down and talked with them about this, and they have, it's FTE problems. But that's if we're on a timeline and you set us, you've given us a policy and you say make this happen, and it's been a big change. I mean, it's a huge investment. We're going to be in for $66 million and $22 million a year. We need a little help from the other side that this law gets is taken seriously and people are complying with it. I mean, we're doing our part.
Fair enough. Don't see any other questions. Thank you for testifying on this bill. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify? Maybe the OLCC. I will note that they do have testimony in OLIS. So here comes the enforcement piece of the conversation, perhaps.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet. I am a policy analyst with the OLCC. You have my written testimony in the record, so I will paraphrase. I think Mr. Gilliam has accurately described what the bill does, how the system works. I'd like to speak a little bit to the resources that we have developed, that we have devoted to this at the OLCC. At the Commission, our primary mission is public safety and the generation of revenue through the sale of distilled spirits. We have recently added the responsibility of recreational marijuana to the agency. Currently, and historically, we have had less than one full-time employee devoted to administration of the bottle bill. Since 2011, statutory changes have increased OLCC's responsibility in administering the bill, including obtaining data to calculate the statewide redemption rates, submitting reports to the legislature, as well as contacting retailers that do not participate in redemption centers regarding their compliance. And on this point, I again would like to specify that when we're talking about compliance, when Mr. Gilliam is talking about compliance, he's talking about the compliance with the redemption center order and those services which non-participating dealers are required to do in order to be equivalent with a redemption center. We're not talking about rogue retailers that are just refusing to accept containers. That's a separate problem, and we have separate processes to deal with that. OLCC faces challenges in administering the bottle bill, including siting redemption centers in densely populated areas, inadequate resources to devote to the bottle bill enforcement, and addressing potential increase in the refund value from 5 to 10 cents in 2017. This bill imposes additional requirements on the agency. Under the bill, we would be required to post notice to all retailers not participating within 5 days, inspect these retailers within 30 days, and we will be required to obtain and track data from retailers who sell less than 100,000 containers per year. Without additional resources, these requirements will have a significant effect on our ability to adequately administer the bottle bill. The agency historically has relied on informal enforcement mechanisms in order to achieve compliance. I think we have had some success in that regard. You've heard from Mr. Gilliam that he would like more. It's important to note that not all retailers in Oregon possess liquor licenses that participate in a bottle bill, so our administrative authority over those licenses is lacking. Over those non-licensed entities is lacking. It's also important to note that any suspension contemplated here is likely subject to the Administrative Procedures Act, which means the agency can't necessarily go in and shut down somebody for non-compliance the instant we learn of it. We would be required to provide them notice, provide them hearings rights, go through that entire process. And that is one of the reasons that we have tended to use informal enforcement techniques. So thank you. My testimony is in the record, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Just curious, do you know if the OLCC's budget request included the resources and FTE to better administer this program?
Chair Holvey, I believe it does not.
It does not.
I would have to verify that for certain, but my belief is that it does not.
And so if this bill were implemented, how do you have an idea? I'm sure we'll get a fiscal at some point, but do you have any idea how many FTE it would take to administer this program?
Chair Holby,
effectively?
We do not have a fiscal yet. I'm not the fiscal analyst. So I can't answer that question at this time, but as the bill currently stands, my assumption is that there will be a fiscal impact to the agency.
All right. Good enough. Thank you for your testimony this morning. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2803? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2803.
Walmart doesn't have a lobbyist.
Shocked.
I think they're cutting expenses because they're worried we're going to raise the minimum wage.
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2439.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure has been before you twice. It requires the party requesting a hearing to be reopened with the Office of Administrative Hearings to provide a copy of the request to the Employment Department. It allows the Employment Department to dismiss a request for hearing with the OAH under specified circumstances, declares an emergency. The Dash 1 amendment was adopted by the committee February 18th. In it, it specifies that if the Employment Department dismisses a hearings request, the party may request a hearing on the dismissal. There is no revenue impact on the Dash 1 amendment. There is a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 1.
Barton,
you make a motion to the floor. We've already amended it, as I recall. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2439 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2439 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Matthew, let's have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Dougherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Excused.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. It's Bill 2439, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. Volunteers to carry this bill? Thank you. Representative Barreto, very kind of you. With that,
you are very welcome.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2439.
Do we have a Barreto on the committee? I thought we had a Bonetto.
Oh, here we go.
I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2805.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure includes the base pay of corrections employees of the five most populous cities as a comparable factor to be considered by the arbitrator when establishing the base pay for Department of Corrections employees. There is the proposed Dash 1 amendment that instead of looking at the five most populous cities, it is the five most populous counties. The measure was heard February 23rd. Through my fault, I don't have the fiscal impact yet, so the committee can adopt the amendment, but cannot move the bill yet. And there's no revenue impact.
Thank you. Representative Barton, can we have a motion on the Dash 1 amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move that the Dash 1 amendments be incorporated into House Bill 2805.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 1 amendment be adopted to House Bill 2805. Discussion on the amendment? On the motion? Seeing none, is there objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendment is adopted. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2805. I believe that finishes our agenda for the day. Anything else, Jan? Anything for good of the order? Thank you, committee. And with that, I adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. Thank you. Business and Labor. Thank you.